Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we are going to be talking about a subject matter that I think you're going to find quite interesting. I know I did. And that's about one of the most notorious gangsters in American history, and I'm going to use that bit of drama. His name, Al Capone. The woman we're going to be talking with today is Deidre Marie Capone. That's right, she's related. In fact, Al Capone was her uncle. Deidre, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. I enjoy being here and speaking with your audience.
Well, I know you're going a mile a minute since this book came out. I met you at the National Publicity Summit back in the spring. And my goodness, to just be aware that there was a relative that even wanted to publish anything about him, it was just amazing. But what was even more amazing to me is the feeling of affection that you have towards this uncle of yours. And I just think, this is really something I want to know more about. Because being of Italian heritage, of course, Capone is a Paisan. And by golly, his history is quite fascinating. Deidre, why did you feel you had to write about this? So many times when people have an infamous character in their family, they don't want anybody to know about it. What was the difference in your case?
There are two things. Number one, I hid for most of my life. But the first thing is my youngest two boys graduated from Northwestern University in Chicago, and then they went on to get their MBAs at the University of Chicago. So they were born and raised somewhat in Chicago, then we left, but then they went back, and they would see references, derogatory references, to Al Capone various times throughout the city, and I mean, they carry that DNA in them. And so they begged me to write a book, because when we would have family storytelling times, and I would tell them about, you know, everything about the Capone family, it just didn't fit with, in their minds, with what the public knew. And the second thing, there are 100 books out there that have been written about Al Capone or the Capone family, and not a single one of those authors ever knew him, ever saw him, ever heard him. They did all of their research by going to old newspaper articles, and we know how accurate those can be, don't we?
Oh, yes, right.
So they would put their own spin on it. They would, you know, put their own mark on the story, the reporting that they are doing, and it's wrong. So I'm 71, and I just want a chance to at least get a book out there that people can read that will give them a different view. And, you know, people that are reading it and they report back to me, that's exactly what's happening, and so it does make me feel good.
I had to chuckle when I looked at the title of your first chapter. It says, I don't like mustard, and I'm related to Al Capone. And I thought, that is a cool way to start a book. Now, your grandfather, let's talk about a little bit of history here.
Mm-hmm.
Your grandfather, Ralph Capone, was listed as public enemy number 3 by the Chicago Crime Commission. So that makes you the grandniece of his partner and younger brother, public enemy number 1, Al Capone.
Correct.
Wow.
And, yes, my grandfather was Al's oldest brother. And, you know, I've had some comments, you know, how well did I know my uncle? How well did I know my granduncle? Well, my grandfather was in a kind of a sticky situation, not a sticky situation, but a unique situation, because Al went to Chicago with his wife and son. My grandfather was still in New York And he was married and was just had my father, a son who was 18 months older than Al's son. Anyway, my grandfather, their father, died, just dropped dead, and left his mother and five needy siblings at home in their Brooklyn apartment without any form of support, with no income, which put the total burden on my grandfather. So he called Al. They talked about it. Al said, you know, I think there's a business opportunity here. I can't do it. You're the businessman. You've got to come to Chicago and do it. So my grandfather went to Chicago. His wife and son wouldn't go because she was an actress and wanted to be on Broadway. But one day, my grandfather got a call from a neighbor in the apartment building and said, you know, Florence left Ralphie here 3 days ago, and we don't know where she is. So he went back to New York, got his son, brought his son to Chicago, where his mother, my grandmother, raised him as the youngest sibling in that family. So that's why the generations are very blurred for me. My father called his father Ralph. He called his uncle Al. It was as though they were brothers.
Wow. Now, the Al Capone was a pretty savvy business guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he also was intuitive. You said that he had, in your book, that he had a number of experiences where he was warned of attempts on his life.
He was very psychic. I'm very psychic. If you just think Al Capone ruled, you know, Chicago during the Roaring Twenties, never got wounded. The only time he was ever wounded was when he was in Alcatraz. Never got wounded. He knew where he shouldn't be when he shouldn't be there.
This is something that I just found so very, very interesting. Now, he was a man that was accused of being behind the St. Valentine's massacre.
Correct.
Give us the facts on this.
If the truth be known about that one incident, my life would have been a lot different. Al Capone was in Florida, in Miami. He was appearing that very time before a federal investigator for the IRS, and he was pleading his case about how much taxes he owed. And when he heard that, he was enraged because he was having a problem with Bugsy Moran. Bugsy wanted more business. And, you know, and my uncle and my grandfather would tell me, you know, there's enough business for everybody here. We don't have to, you know, encroach and do things in other places. So my grandfather told Jack McGurn, who was a close family friend, and my Aunt Matthew was madly in love with him, to put the fear of God in Bugsy Moran. So when this whole thing blew up, Al was very upset. He thought Bugsy goofed up and overstepped his bounds. But their youngest brother, my uncle, Matty, was outside in a car at the time this whole thing happened. He saw the touring car with policemen inside go into the garage, and of course they took off. But when they saw the you know, newspaper articles, they were mm-hmm. concerned. In those days, there were different outfits, you know, the Moran outfit, the O'Donnell outfit, the Capone outfit. You know, they all had their little piece of serving the public with what they wanted: gambling, prostitution, and alcohol. That's the only thing they were involved in. The police couldn't take sides. They couldn't say that Capone was better or this one was better. So they allowed those guys to take care of their own business their own way. And they were on the take. I mean, my family's business paid for more college educations for, you know, the police than I can even count, you know. But they were all in this business together. When Moran found out that the policemen were stealing cases of liquor off of their trucks and selling it. They said that they were going to go to their lieutenant, their police lieutenant, and, you know, say, I mean, you guys shouldn't be doing that. Well, the police were afraid of losing their jobs. They needed, you know, put food on the table for their kids, and so they set that whole thing up that everybody would be shot so they wouldn't have to turn into the police. And I know this very well because there was one person that was killed that was supposedly a mechanic. That person was the brother-in-law of my father-in-law, and he told my husband's family the real story about the Valentine's Day massacre to back up what my uncle told me.
Fascinating history. I wonder if ever that will be shown in the history books. Because
I hope so, Donna. I hope so.
Well, there are so many things that have been written about police departments, especially in the big cities. And Chicago was a pretty hot spot at that time.
Yes.
And Prohibition is a part of American history, and you get all kinds of angles on it. But it really was a big money-making enterprise, and it didn't work the way people who initiated it thought that it would or
mm-hmm.
hoped that it would. But it created a tremendous amount of business. I mean, Joseph Kennedy, the father of Robert Kennedy, that's how he made his money.
And
the Rockefellers were involved
yep.
in it.
Correct.
I mean, you have all of this history, and so many times people want to sweep it under the rug. They just say, oh, no, that couldn't have happened. It did. This was a time in history where people, number one, were having a hard time to survive.
Correct.
And number two, the way to make money was just, you know, absolutely imperative. And this was one way that people did it. I mean, this is,
yeah.
and they, what is it in the South? They were avoiding the revenuers.
yeah.
This is something that was going on all the time. And the corruption in the police departments at that time was so well known.
Yep.
It wasn't even funny. I mean, it's just, it really was. So you have all of this that was going on, and you make a comment in your book that if it hadn't been for 13 years of prohibition from 1920 to 1933, Capone would have been nothing. There
Correct.
Would have been no Al Capone.
Correct.
And that's fascinating.
You brought up a very good point about the Kennedys and the Rockefellers and the Capones. I did a school project once, and I laid out those families, you know, chronologically and saw their beginnings and stuff. The reason you don't hear derogatory things about the Kennedys and, you know, the Rockefellers, and they all did the same thing, they imported the same liquor, they killed the same people, they, you know, did everything the same, was because a male descendant came along and they brought respectability back to the family name.
Mm-hmm.
My father was earmarked for that. My father went through St. John's Prep School, Notre Dame, Loyola, Roosevelt. He was a scholar. And he passed the bar, but the Chicago Bar Association would not allow him to practice.
Mm-hmm.
With John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Nelson Rockefeller, they did practice, and what they did is they expunged the records of their fathers from the history books.
Ah, there we go. Well, it's not unusual, and those that have a chance to have an opportunity to talk to someone like you who is documenting
Correct.
Your family's legacy, and there is so much to it. There is so
yeah.
much behind it,
yeah.
and it's really tough unless you are able to talk with people who really, really know. Now, Al Capone knew Jack Dempsey, Al Jolson, George Jessel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here are stars of their period. I mean, these were really, really big people. I have to share a story with you. I remember reading this when I was a little girl. I was an avid reader then, just as I am today. And this was a story about a young lady who had left some Midwestern town that she had been raised in. I think it had a total population of 700 people. It was one of those little tiny towns. It was tough times. She wanted to make a living. She was very pretty. And somehow or another, she ended up getting an opportunity to dance, which she wanted to do. She ends up in a nightclub. And the patterning of the environment there was going to more than likely put her into a positioning of prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is that your Uncle Al noticed her. She didn't fit. She was this Midwestern girl, very sweet, just untouched. He recognized that she didn't belong in this hoochie-coochie club. And he called her over, wanted to know where she was from, talked to her, and then gave her some money. Of course, he had the scar on his face
mm-hmm.
at that time, and she knew who he was. Everybody knew who Al Capone was.
Mm-hmm.
And she said he gave her money, and he told her, you don't belong here, go home.
Mm-hmm.
And she did. And she made the comment in the article, and again, I was just a kid when I read this. And in the article, she said, that for all of the notoriety he got, that he never, any time when he was talking to her, was forward or anything like that. He was someone that wanted her to leave the environment that she was in because she didn't belong there.
Do you
and
know
it changed
the name?
Her life.
Do you know the name of that person?
No, I don't. It was in a magazine years and years and years ago, and I just thought, it stuck in my head. I think because it was so out of character as to what I had heard. Because
correct.
Being of an Italian background, they would talk about these different mafias and the Italian mafia and the Jewish mafia and
yep.
the Greek
yep, yep.
mafia. And you yep. name every nationality that's a mafia. And, you know, this would be a conversation at the table.
Well, I think who you're talking about is Gilda Gray. Do you know that
name? I
don't
know. No, I don't.
Gilda Gray, I mean, yes, he did give her money. He told her that she could be a star. She didn't need to do what she was, you know, planning
mm-hmm.
on doing. Gilda Gray performed at the 1933 World's Fair because Al Capone got her in there. Gilda Gray was the inventor of the shimmy.
Ooh, I don't know that it was this young woman. I don't think so. I
okay.
think Gilda was somebody else. But tell us about Gilda. That's cool. What did she do?
Anybody
that could have invented the shimmy, you know this is an interesting gal.
Well, and Gilda Gray was the grandmother of John Gray, who did The Sopranos.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. What a small world.
Mm-hmm.
Then he has a lot of family background that really made it comfortable for him to do The Sopranos. He knew exactly what he wanted to convey.
But look at it. Look, he could have done The Sopranos to be, you know, Gotti-like or something, and he didn't. I mean, they were a family. I mean, they had issues. I mean, they certainly did have issues, but they were not cold-blooded killers, and they did pattern it after the Capones.
Fascinating. Let's go
oh,
back.
Oh, I
to
have
them.
So many things like this to tell people.
It's
I
wonderful.
Put them in the book,
you really
but I
ought
have...
to just sit down and do it, talk into a recorder and just chit chat and gab.
I know. But...
And then put it all down and then have somebody transcribe it for you because it's these little tiny golden nuggets about things about people.
Yep.
And it's all history. And he is a very significant portion of history relative to the era because of all the notoriety that was put around him. Now, let's go back to something you mentioned a moment ago, and that was about dealing with the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the story goes that's what ended up putting him in jail, but you have something about how Al paid his taxes, your Uncle Al, and he paid his taxes, which he was supposed to be, $47,000. This was in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us that story. I thought this was a hoot.
Well, it wasn't the taxes. It was the interest and the penalty.
Okay.
Al had gone to prison. I mean, people need to read my book, Uncle Al Capone, and they will understand how torturous and horrible that was. But anyway, he was due to get out, and there was a commissioner of revenue who heard that Al Capone was going to get out of Alcatraz, and he just happened to see if he ever paid the cost of the trial penalty and interest, and he had not. So he called my grandfather, said, "Ralph, I mean, you got to take care of this for me. I've got to get out of here." So my grandfather called the commissioner of the IRS that was in Cook County and said, "You know, I see that my brother still owes all of this money. I would like to come down and pay it to you." And so the commissioner said, "Okay, you know, come on down on such and such a day." And so this day arrived, and the doorman downstairs, you know, called up to the commissioner and said, "You know, Ralph Capone is here to pay the fine, you know, the money that Al Capone owes. And so the guy said, "Well, send him up." And he says, "I don't think you understand. You've got to come downstairs." So he came downstairs, and there were two wagons in the alley, and they had brought the exact money that Al Capone owned in pennies.
Now, what fun.
This commissioner had to count it and make sure that it was all there before he could mark, you know, that the payment was received and the debt was clear. So he started to do it himself, and he couldn't do it, and he had to hire all of these people to do it for him. For a while after that, there was an amendment to the law and the Constitution that you could no longer pay your taxes in coins.
Mm-hmm.
That was my grandfather that did that.
Your granddaddy did all of that, took care of it. You have something in here that really touched me, and that is your section about the family and food. Mm-hmm. And this is really going to sound corny to people, dandelion soup. And let me mm-hmm. tell you why this part was so significant to me. Again, I've got Italian background. I had a very dear Italian friend whose name was Sal. Mm-hmm. And this is a man I'd known for almost 30 years, just a wonderful man. He just passed away last year. And he would tell me, because he was born in Italy and his family immigrated here to the United States and he was in New York, he would tell me about how times were so tough. And when he was growing up, when they were in the U.S., because the Depression was going on.
Correct.
And he said, my mother would get together with her lady friends, and they would go out and pick wild greens when mm-hmm. spring came around. Mm-hmm. And dandelions was something that they would go out and get because it was healthy. And he said, we really never went hungry, but my mother and her friends would go out because the Italian women were taught this by their mothers and their grandmothers and so on and so forth. And he said they would go out into areas of land that were available at that time. It's not available today. And they would go after these greens. And you have a recipe for dandelion soup mm-hmm. here in your book. Why was it so special to your family?
My grandmother taught me that food is medicine. And mm-hmm. it really, truly is.
Yes, it
and
is.
And her belief was, living in Chicago, you're inside all winter, you're, you know, the heat comes from coal. You know, there's a lot of debris, you know, burning coal in the house. So she felt that your body was filled with all kinds of toxins. So the spring was the time to clean the toxins out of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Dandelions leach toxins out of your body, as does rhubarb. And she was big in rhubarb also.
Mm-hmm. And that takes, you know, that is vitamin A. It's got calcium in it, potassium, mm-hmm. iron. And this is so true. This
is
so true. The people in the Ozarks did the same thing. They
yep.
had their spring tonic because
yep.
you had all of this congestion. Lung congestion was very common in their environment. So detoxifying the body was very, very popular. Now, a big point of information, and I know those of you listening, you're going to want to get this book because it presents a lot more detail than what we're giving. But I was blown away because of all the things I've heard all through the years, that Uncle Al Capone, did not die on Saturday evening, January 25, in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't die of syphilis.
He died, history books think he died in the morning. No, I'm sorry, they think he died in the evening. You're right, that's the history books. He died in the morning. And I would like to ask your listeners, how many people they know that died of syphilis. I mean, you don't die of syphilis. You might have health complications, and during, you know, around the turn of the century, there was nothing, no safe sex. Everybody had some form of venereal disease at one time or another, and they, you know, had it until, you know, penicillin and antibiotics came along. But it did not kill you. What happened was my uncle became a model prisoner in Alcatraz. And by the way, he was sentenced to 11 years for income tax evasion, where Frank Nitti and my grandfather, Ralph Capone, were sentenced to 3 years for the same amount of money for the same years. I think somebody had a vendetta against Al Capone. Anyway, he became a model prisoner, and he was due to get out. And the powers to be contacted my grandfather, and he told me this himself, and said, you know, we've got a new treatment for syphilis. We would like to try it out on your brother. And, you know, they did that. I mean, still today, I think they try a lot of different things out on prisoners that are in our prisons. So my grandfather agreed to it. It was then that you started to hear all of these reports in the newspapers that Al Capone was going mad, he was crazy, you know, he was angry, he was doing all this. When he got out of prison and my mother was there when he came to Chicago, he didn't know anybody. He would go up to his own mother and say, "Who are you?" He would go up to his brother, "Who are you?" And then he would go back to his mother, "Who are you?" Well, my grandfather took him to Baltimore, to Johns Hopkins, and what they treated him with the last year that he was incarcerated was mercury. They thought that mercury would cure syphilis. If you've read Alice in Wonderland, there was a character called the Mad Hatter. The Mad Hatter would sew the hats for royalty, and in order to make his job easier, he would dip the thread in mercury so it would slide easier, and it would cut his fingers, and it would drive him mad. When they leached those poisons out of my uncle's body, he was himself again. He taught me to play the mandolin. We sang together. We cooked together. And when these people go, these authors go to write something about my uncle and my family, and they go back to the newspaper articles and they read these things, it perpetuates. It goes on and on and on. And so I've got to do whatever time I have left here, God willing, to try to tell people that there is a different side. Please listen to me.
Well, I'll tell you, you've got a lot of quotes from Uncle Al, and I'm going to read one, especially with all the news that's going on with Mr. Weiner at this time and the other things that have come forth, okay? This is just one of the quotes that Al made, and it's, "Graft is a byword in American life today. It is law where no law is obeyed. It is undermining this country. The honest lawmakers of any city can be counted on your fingers. I could count Chicago's on one hand."
Yes.
Well, guess what? We're going through the same kind of scenario that was going on at that time in a different expression, but it's still the same old stuff. Deidre, there's so much more. We could talk for hours about this, and of course that's not going to be possible, but I would love for my listeners to know about the website where they can find out more about Uncle Al Capone and your relationship, the family, what really went on. Because I think it's great. You're bringing forth information that is history and really can shake up a lot of people in a very special way. So tell us how they can do it.
Go to UncleAlCapone.com, and there you can read, you know, all kinds of things. If you want to order an autographed copy of the book, it can be done there. My book is available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and in all of your local bookstores. They have it.
Well, I'll tell you what. This has just been a delight. And I really like what you give out about Italian history and how they were treated. Isn't it interesting? Every flood of immigrants, whether it was the Irish whether it was Jewish, whether it was Italian, yeah. whether it was Greek, there was always prejudice. And look at how long it's taken for the integration to occur, and we still have the same battle going on today in other with other ethnicities. But that's what makes this country what it is. It was what yeah. creates its greatness and also the challenges that we have to deal with as far as the diversity goes. Deidre, it has been absolutely a delight. Deidre Capone has been my guest
Thank
today.
You.
Find out more about the fascinating story, the truth about her uncle, Al Capone, and it'll change your perspective in a lot of ways. Deidre, again, thank you for being my guest. Uncle Al Capone is the name of the book. Check it out. It's fascinating reading. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Thanks.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open, 888-815-9756. If you would like to check in with me and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Quick like a bunny, I want to mention to those of you who are in the Seattle area, I am going to be appearing, giving a talk on Sunday at the Tower Memorial Church. We're going to talk about how to be able to be successful and dare to fail. So if you are in that area and you would like to join me, it's at 11 o'clock. You can go to my newsletter, also to my website, find the address, the location, and all of the information necessary to be able to get to it. So it's Sunday at 11 o'clock, June the 12th. I'm a month ahead. Good gracious. June 12th, this coming Sunday, and I'm going to be speaking in Seattle. So you can get all the information right off of my website, which is DelphiInternational.com. Well, tomorrow we're going to be talking about a vitamin we all hear about. It's vitamin D. Now, it was discovered many years ago to prevent rickets. Children who were going through awful, awful physical conditions, their bones just were not developing. They were missing this nutrient. They found it in cod liver oil. Well, we even know more today, and vitamin D can be obtained, of course, from the sun. If you live in a sunny environment, that's great. But hey, if you are like me and you're in the northern environments where there's more gray than there is that glowing gold, well, by golly, you have to add this to your diet. Otherwise, you can have a number of things that can go wrong. So we're going to be talking tomorrow with Lucinda Messer. And I believe you'll find her a fascinating lady. She's made a study of this, and she's got a lot to share. So that's who we're going to be with tomorrow, and I invite you to join me. Again, give me a buzz if you want to chat, 888-815-9756. Now, before I came on air today, there was a program I just happened to turn on and on television, and I'm always looking for interesting material. Well, it was a particular person. I don't know the man's name right off the top of my head, but he was talking about an area of the world that is Asian, Thailand, actually, and he was talking about the cashew. And I love cashews. They're just one of my favorite nuts. I've always enjoyed them. And, of course, you can't eat too many of them because if you do, you're going to end up looking like one, you know, rather plump and round, and you don't want to do that. But they have got a wonderful source of nutrients. However, I got a real education on this. I had no idea that the cashews are encased in a shell that is highly toxic. So he was talking about the people who in Thailand, and they're generally women, that gather up these nuts in their pods, and they have a process of cooking, and these seeds exude a toxin that scars and burns the skin, the fingers. I mean, this stuff is really, really bad. So I decided I was going to look it up on Wikipedia, and my goodness, I forget how many tons of this is exported. And people around the world eat it, and we don't think twice about it. So I'm watching all of this information, and I said, holy Moses, I don't have enough time to make notes, so let me go to Wikipedia, and let's see what I can find out. Well, this is what I learned about one of the favorite nuts in the world. One, the largest cashew tree in the world, covers an area of about 7,500 square meters. That is equivalent to 81,000 square feet. And it's just, that's an incredible sized tree. I wonder how old it is. Now, the fruit that develops around the nut is sort of pear-shaped. And it's called in Central America cashew apple. And it grows to about 5 to 11 centimeters long. Now, this particular apple, as they call it, the fruit that surrounds the nut is apparently quite juicy, but they can't export it because it's something that doesn't survive export very, very well. It has a delicious flavor, and in Latin America, it is very, very popular. Now, within the fruit is the cashew nut. Now, the cashew really is a seed. It's not truly a nut. And this seed is surrounded by a double shell that contains an allergenic phenolic resin, anacardic acid. Now, this is an acid that is used typically in pesticides. My education is growing. However, it is an extremely potent skin irritant, and it's chemically related to an allergenic oil, urushiol, which is a toxin that is also found in poison ivy. Fascinating stuff. Now, the cashews have to be roasted so that the toxin can be destroyed, but it's got to be done outdoors. If it's not roasted outdoors, it is going to be life-threatening. It's not unlike what happens when people burn poison ivy. Now, I've never lived in an environment where poison ivy is abundant, but apparently one of the control factors was to burn it. Well, it releases this toxic substance. It's called urushiol droplets, and it irritates your lungs. It actually can kill a person if you inhale too much of it. People will become allergic to the cashew urushiols, and they're also, if they become allergic to that, they may also react to mango or pistachios, which are in this particular plant family. And another interesting point is that fewer people ever get allergic to cashews, interestingly enough, with all that I've shared with you here. More people are allergic to peanuts. I have a very dear friend. If he just gets, just puts a peanut or anything that has a peanut residue in his mouth, he has to be taken to the hospital. He doesn't know why, but it's just his body system. And, even though these cashews that I'm speaking of were native to Brazil, the Portuguese are the ones that took the plant to Goa, India. And they took the plant to India in the 1500s. And it spread through Southeast Asia and eventually ended up in Africa. Well, it's got the right climate. It's tropical climate, and these trees, these just are absolutely wonderful. Now, I'll tell you something about this lethal toxic acid, anacardic acids. This is something that they utilize. Even though that there is this toxin that's in the shell, science is always researching because they're trying to find out how it can help people in their lives. Well, they use it for tooth abscesses because often people that have an abscess have what they call a gram-positive bacteria. This works at negating that. And also, the bark of the cashew tree is soaked overnight. They scrape it off, they soak it overnight, and then they boil it as an anti-diarrheal. It also, the tree also yields a gum that's used in varnish. And the seeds of the tree can be ground into powders used for antivenom for snake bites. And the nut oil is used as an antifungal and also for helping to heal people that have cracked heels. Now stop and think of living in an environment, not like our environment, but in an environment where you're in this tropical space, you're walking around barefoot most of the time. These are people that on their own determined what they could do, and then science today with its technology and the base of wisdom that we have been able to learn through the years, we are finding that there are more and more uses for this. And also, anacardic acid that's in the shell is used in the chemical industry for production of cardinal, which is used in resins, coatings, and frictional materials. Fascinating, amazing stuff. I mean, cashew fruit juice, Brazil. Malaysia, young leaves of the cashew tree are eaten raw as a salad. Panama, it's cooked, the cashew fruit is cooked with water and sugar, and it makes a brown, very sweet, tastes like dessert. And Philippines, it's eaten with suman. Indonesia, it's called mente, the cashew nut. They roast and salt the cashews. I mean, there's so much information here. And who would have thought just from this one plant we'd have all of this? But when I saw the pictures of these women who earn, I think, 35 cents a day by dealing in this environment, doing a lot of this work by hand, and the scars and the things that they're aware of, and they have physicians on site to help these people deal with it. It's amazing, amazing stuff. So, you know, sometimes when you happen to watch television and you come across these programs that are dealing with environment, someone's gone out there and they have brought all of this information to you. It's wonderful that in today's world we have access to so much information that we have to be discerning and discriminating about what we watch is very important, I think, because if you put garbage into your head, you're going to get garbage out. But I really believe the more we come to understand how things relate, how components come from all over the world, from different environments, and how very important it is that we share that knowledge and that understanding. It makes our life, one, more interesting. Two, we're able to appreciate how people have been able to put things together. But three, we may also discover why something is toxic, why we maybe shouldn't use it in certain ways, why we should look for other adaptations. It's amazing. We live in a fascinating world that is brought to life by billions of people on this planet. And the plant world, I'll tell you, there is so much information about plants and how we utilize them to make our lives better. It's really fascinating stuff. So check out Wikipedia. If you're interested in what I just shared with you, you can get more details there. And you can look up anything. It's just fascinating to me how you've got all of these resources available via the Internet. I was able to get it in just seconds. It's marvelous. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9755. 866-472-5756. We're going to be back in just a moment.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. I really have a delightful story about a mother and her little girl, and also actually how this little girl actually has two moms. But before I do that, I wanted to talk about someone, Tara Kristoff. This is a woman who really is about supporting new thinking. And she is involved in all kinds of creative venues. She's written books. But she said something about leadership that I think is extremely important. And this is what she said. The soul of the world is calling for our leadership. Each of us has sacred gifts and medicine to offer our world. Each of us is a catalyst for social change. Together and individually, we are now being called to embrace the new paradigm for healing our global landscape and to create new models of leadership. To wholeheartedly embody these larger shifts that we wish to see in the world, we must marry our inner changes with outer changes. The veil of darkness asks our souls to go deep and experience the grief of the world so that we can engage our leadership from a place of depth and vision. Now is also the time for creating and nourishing our communities. These vital supports will sustain us as we bring our gifts forward in a world that is hungry for them but not always ready to receive them. We must be as shamans, walking between the old familiar structures and birthing the new ones. As we claim our leadership, our world asks us to remember indigenous wisdom and reimagine the possibilities envisioned by great teachers such as Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. It is our individual and collective imagination that will carry us towards a future that beholds the birthing of a new paradigm. Being educated, being well-read, understanding what you feel about yourself and what is most important to you is absolutely necessary. We as people need to realize that we, each of us, count. We have to be aware of how significant our roles are. And if we hold integrity with ourselves and we walk that integrity and that sense of value and that sense of purpose, we can't help but have an effect on others. But we must have dominion over ourselves. That is the key. Dominion over our mind, our attitudes, our emotions. And that takes discipline. It takes being mindfully present. Have you ever had a day when things have gone wrong and you just really are grinding your teeth and you just want to be like Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry and say, make my day?
and punch somebody. I mean, we all have days like that. I don't know of anybody that doesn't have moments where you just go, ugh, I've had it. I don't have patience with anything. It's always good when you can step away. It's always good when you can take a walk around the block, pull those emotions back into play and say, wait a minute, I'm going to use this energy for something that is going to have purpose and value. I'm not going to go backwards. I'm going to go forward. And I'm going to be having dominion over how I respond, what I'm looking at, and I'm going to be expecting that I am going to have the best that's possibly available to me. I'm going to have dominion over my space. It really does make a difference. And I think that Tara, in her words, as I read them to you, expressed something that's very important. If each and every person were to have that discipline, and we were to exercise that discipline in a positive way, we couldn't help but cause a wave of change that could transform the world. But it does not just one person. It's one plus one plus one plus one. It's sort of like etiquette. When you understand what proper etiquette and courtesy is, and you demonstrate it, other people copy you. They say, this is good, this is, and you have that standard. That is what creates the change. And I believe that that change is evolving. And it is coming in ways that, well, maybe would not have been envisioned. But without the leadership to be the example, the results may be disappointing otherwise. Well, I wanted to share this story about Kathleen Jones. She said that she had waited 8 years to be able to have a child. And during that time, she and her husband were disappointed so frequently because as much as they wanted a child, for one reason or another, even if papers were signed and they thought everything was going to come about and there'd be a baby in their home, it just didn't happen. There was one setback after the other. Well, there came the day when there was a young woman who was pregnant, did not have the capacity of taking care of the child, and was giving it up for adoption. And Kathleen was able to become a mom. And she said, it was so exciting to me because this was a young woman who, if circumstances had been different, maybe she would have kept this little girl. But she said, I knew that the day was going to come that my child, my beautiful daughter, was going to want to meet her birth mother. And she said, I made sure through the years that I kept all the mementos about the various holidays and the different things that we had enjoyed and the Mother's Day's memories. And she said, I didn't know when it was going to happen, but I knew the day was going to come that I was going to share my daughter with the birth mother. And she said, I really worked it out in my mind because I wanted her to know that we raised the child with love for the birth mother, with the understanding that there were some extenuating circumstances and that she just wanted to be sure that the birth mother knew that she has been a wonderful blessing to their lives. And also, that there was no resentment or any hard feelings about this. And she said, all I want to know is that I will share her with you with the same faith and hope that I know you have within your own heart. Treat her gently and love her. That is what I ask now, just as you once asked of me when your baby daughter was given to us in our home. What a wonderful, wonderful attitude this is. And I've known so many people that have looked for their families and wanted to know their birth history, and they've never been able to find it. But Kathleen said, there are really two moms for my little girl, and both of us love her deeply. Great story. This is Donna Sebo. I know we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have an absolutely awesome day or evening wherever you might be, and hope to see you back here tomorrow, same time, same place, right here
on BBS Radio. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.